All right, good morning. Welcome to this session. Do you have something you want to say?
Good morning, everyone. My name is Naomi. I'm the room monitor for this session. Just a friendly reminder to please turn off your cell phones. If you're collecting continuing education units, please sign the sheet in the back right now and then check in with me at the end of the session. And this session is being recorded, so a reminder that if you have any questions or comments, to please come up and use the microphones.
All right, thank you for that. Well, welcome to this session, looking at dreams about God and research on that theme, drawing on long-term dream journals, both contemporary and, in my case, a historical dream journal. And these presentations will be using different methodologies and coming at the subject from different angles, so I'm not quite sure what to expect from my co-panelists, but I'm looking forward to it. So our first presenter, Nori Muster, a writer and journalist, a long-term dream journal keeper, who is going to share her latest research with us.
Thank you very much. Okay, thank you. I wanted to start out by acknowledging, thanking ASD and DSF for helping me complete this phase of my study. They were really instrumental in, I won the DSF grant and was able to travel to Santa Barbara for 4 weeks this year, which is not cheap. And I spent that time in the library transcribing my dream journals. And so just a few statistics and facts about the collection. I was in ISKCON for 10 years when I was younger. It's the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. And I wrote a memoir about it, which you can look at. I brought a copy with me. The first 10 years of my journals covers the 10 years that I was in ISKCON. So these are the dreams and memories from being a Hare Krishna devotee. The journals span 1979 to 1989. And there were 37 notebooks, 2,006 daytime notations, 1,313 dreams recorded, and the transcript is 1,223 pages. So I went through, after I finished transcribing the journals, this transcript became like a really fun toy, like you might get on Christmas morning. And I've gone through it, I've tagged all the main characters, and I counted them, and I can put the thing through Excel, and it'll come out, I can sort it, I can get all the dreams, because they're under D, and then I can get all the notations under N. I can single out the dreams with the tags, or the dreams with the tags and the dreams. You know, the date, tags, and dreams. And the notations, I can get the notations, date, and tags, and the first paragraph of the notations, because then Excel sends them all different ways. So one of the things that stands out about this collection is the language, because when you enter a religious cult, you learn a whole new language. And in ISKCON, the language we learned was mostly Sanskrit and Bengali words, and also the cult jargon. So one of the, for example, ecstatic. We were always ecstatic, you know. Like everything was ecstatic, and that word appears about 100 times in the transcript. And I'm gonna create a before and after set. So this is before cult recovery, so it's when I was in the group. And then I was a fringy for about 10 years while I wrote my memoir and got my master's degree, and then the after series will begin after I quit going to temples, which was in 1998. So it's been about 20 years since I've gone to any Hare Krishna temples or participated in anything like that. So I want to share some dreams with you. This panel is Dreams of God, so I picked out dreams about God, and I called God Krishna in the group, and also Jagannath, which is another form of Krishna. So I brought Jagannath with me. This is Jagannath. And it's from Orissa. It's a form of Krishna from Orissa that they take on those big carts. So that's where the word Juggernaut came from, because these big carts would come lumbering down the street with these deities on them. And they were sort of the deities of the people. They weren't like Krishna's more for the Brahmins and the upper classes, but this was a form of Krishna for the people. So I always related to Juggernaut. So the first dream about Juggernaut, I put these in chronological order. So this is a dream dated May 31st, 1987, and it's abridged. I'm trying to defend ISKCON's reputation with public relations. Some friends came dressed in clown and animal outfits to attack me, and I was happy laughing with them and wanting to take and fix lots of mismatched juggernauts. So I would pick these things up at devotee yard sales, and sometimes they would be mismatched, like you'd have a really big juggernaut and then a little Balaram and Subhadra. So they would just, you know, I'd get them at yard sales or people would bring them to me to paint. So that was a dream about that. The second juggernaut I call Earthquake Threat. This one was from November 25th, 1987, and it's abridged. Everyone leaving town at a threat of a big earthquake. I stay with an apartment full of juggernaut deities chanting my rounds. I only had a few rounds done though throughout the dream. So that's an anxiety thing, because we had these pre-dawn ceremonies and you had to chant for 2 hours on your beads. And if you didn't get the chanting done, for me it was like I always felt kind of nervous until I got all my sadhana done. This one's called Bus Trip, and it's February 18th, 1988. I was going to take deities to a temple up the coast for people. Juggernaut for Yashoda, Krishna and Balaram for Karta, and my Gornitai deities and other deities. A bus was leaving, but I missed it. And later I learned that the deities made it on the bus and everything was okay. Okay, this is one, we had a lot of crime in the group. It was really a criminal infested religious cult. And I worked in the PR department, so I was always trying to help the organization. So this is a dream dated October 17, 1986. I dreamed that people I know were deeply involved in the murder the grand jury is investigating. We did everything we could to cover up the crimes of ISKCON. There were juggernaut deities with knots in them, according to our impurities. So we had there was a murder in Los Angeles on May 22nd, 1986, and a friend of mine was murdered by some other Hare Krishnas. And we did the best we could to cover it up, to cover up the murder, by saying, telling the media, well, this guy was excommunicated before it happened, and the shooter was excommunicated. It wasn't really our people that killed each other, you know, just lying to the media. And so the dream just said that the deity, which these are made of wood, I don't know how well you can see it from back there, but that the deities would have knots in them, according to our impurities. So then I want to talk about the process of transcribing the dreams. So first of all, when I joined the Hare Krishnas, I was a senior at UCSB, and I lived in Isla Vista, which is the college town. And I actually moved into the temple the day after graduation, and I wore a sari to graduation. So I was being indoctrinated while I was a senior there. And then just by coincidence, UCSB has the largest collection of cultic material. So when I wanted to clean out my closet and get rid of all this documentation, they were one of the first people I called besides my publisher. And they said, yeah, we want your stuff, you know, send it over, send us your journals, whatever you got. So I just sent them all this stuff in 2005. And so that was why I couldn't just transcribe the dream journals, because they were in a library and they don't give it back to you, so usually. So I had to travel there. So transcribing the dreams in the city where I joined the Hare Krishnas was really deeply meaningful to me. And it was like a gestalt that I could close by transcribing the dreams there. It it brought a lot of the stuff back. So I walked by the apartment where I lived, which I do sometimes when I go there, and this time I found the preaching center, which I had never bothered to do before, and I walked by that and took a picture of it. And so it's like a real trip through nostalgia. And so the dream journals, at the beginning, the first 7 years of dream journals were my indoctrination, where we weren't really allowed to keep journals, and I had kept a journal, but I had to throw it all away when I moved in the temple. So I wanted to start keeping a journal again, and they said I could, but all I could write about was my notes from the classes, my realizations, my prayers, and my sadhana, like what time I finished my rounds or how the morning program was. So the only time they would allow you to write down dreams was if it was about God or about your guru. So mostly the first 100 dreams I recorded were those kind of dreams. And then later I got permission from my boss, because I was having these bad nightmares about my old friends. No wonder. So then the last 3 years were full-on writer's journals, like dreams, first drafts of articles. I worked on their newspaper, you know, all that kind of stuff. And I noticed when I was transcribing, it was like notation, dream, notation, dream, notation, dream. Like every night I had a dream, and every day I wrote something down. So it was, when I transcribed it, I could remember most of the daytime things that happened, like, oh yeah, I remember when that happened, and oh, I remember that, or I remember that person. But when I did the dreams, even though there were 1,300 dreams, I only remembered less than about a dozen where I could actually remember the dream. So I was able to put it together. It was like a jigsaw puzzle, or it's one of those stereo views where you can see three-dimensionally. And I could see my daytime life, where I was really not proud of myself, you know, talking in jargon and just kind of glassy-eyed devotee, you know, cult member. But then the dreams were so compassionate. They didn't judge me. They weren't mad at me. They would just take what I'd done during the day and, you know, kind of review it or go over it in a really loving and accepting way. Forgiving and accepting, like when we were doing that cover up for the murder, it didn't say like, oh, you're a bad person. It just said you have impurities, like that you can see. They could see, my dreams could see. So it was like a really gentle healing thing. And the process of, I didn't want to go back there. Like I thought about, well, where should I start with this dream journal? It's like 38 years worth of dreams. Where do I start with this? Well, I definitely don't want to go back to my 40s. Definitely don't want to go back to my 30s. And I really don't want to go back to the Hare Krishna years. That is just awful. I'll do that last, you know. But then I thought, well, you know, start at the beginning, and, you know. So, but then when I was done transcribing it, it was just like such a meaningful thing to me. It was really life-changing. It got rid of some personal, like, negative things about myself. Like, for all these decades, I was criticizing myself really harshly. Like, how could you be in that stupid group? And when I had to admit to people that I was in that group, I always felt kind of bad about myself. And I just, you know, especially, like, even reading it now, some of the stuff is just really uncomfortable for me. Like, you know, you're talking in brainwash. Like, I wasn't myself, and it was just uncomfortable. But I'm reading the last 3 years. The last 3 years of the journal was my disillusionment. So I became disillusioned with the experience gradually, and then to the point where I left at the end of 1988. And it was really helpful because I reviewed it, and I saw how I ended up leaving. And my husband and I were able to find a way to make a living besides just depending on the group. So we were able to move away from it and get away from it, because when we were ready. So I want to read, I have a couple dreams here that use the word Krishna as God. So I'm going to share those too. This was really kind of an initiation dream. This is one of the earliest dreams I recorded. This is from 1980. So it was a way to say goodbye to my friends, my old friends, and I carried my friends with me through the experience, because even though I didn't see my old friends, I dreamed about them, because I had completely cut myself off from my previous life. So this is the dream. This morning I had a dream that I was going around seeing old friends, and we all rolled in ecstasy together. That means when we would go to the sacred holy place, we would roll in ecstasy and get the dust of the holy place on us. So that's what that means. But I knew I wouldn't see them again for a long time. And I gave one of the friends an amethyst for me to fix for me. Then I dreamed that I went into the altar. I secretly went into the altar to see the deities, and the deities put a magical spell over everything and danced all around like a fairy waltz. This is another dream. This is from March 12th or 13th. Just sit higher. I encountered two crazy men and delayed them. The authorities came and captured them and put them on a train. And then the train went under a tunnel, and then it went off the track. And the conductor roped it and pulled it back on. And then I showed him my pictures of Krishna. He wanted to know what Krishna looked like. I didn't have an exact picture of him, but came very close. And it was the beginning of Krishna consciousness, when trains were just starting too. So I think my dreams about God were my projection of God, and that I didn't have the exact picture of Krishna, but I had one that was very close. Like, I didn't have a snapshot of Krishna, but I had a drawing or a painting that I could share. This is one of my favorite dreams. This was on my birthday in 1986 when I turned 30. And it was the beginning of my disillusionment. This was before I was disillusioned. So this is the full dream. A little girl representing Krishna would wait by some incense, and when the ashes would fall, she would catch them in her hand and give them to me. And it was like we were playing a game. So this was like my playful relationship with Krishna. And then this is the last dream. This is dated December 26, 1987. I go to the temple to make garlands. Ramadasi says the deities are mad at me. So that's my projection, and that was what they taught us in the classes, that when Krishna was mad at you, or when you did something, like if you gossiped about the leaders or said something bad about the gurus, then Krishna would be mad at you, and then you would get some kind of retribution for it to teach you. So that was part of their philosophy. Anyway, so that's about 15 minutes. I could talk longer, but if anyone has any questions, we could sort of direct the conversation in the area that you'd like to talk about.
Hi, good morning. 15 minutes, I mean, it's there's so much stuff there. I mean, I have like a million questions, but I guess the two that come to mind are, you talked about your disillusionment. I'm wondering if the dreams had a part in leading you there, or were they just more of a manifestation of that decision? I mean, my question first. And the second question was, I'm just wondering how your dreams of God are now compared to the way they were before.
Okay.
How that changed. Thank you.
The reason that I asked for permission to keep a dream journal was because I was having a reoccurring nightmare about a friend of mine that I left in the world when I joined. And he, in the dream where I give one of my friends an amethyst, I think it was him because we were both born in February, about a year apart. And he was a friend that I grew up with. And I asked him to fix the amethyst for me. And then later, after I got into my 40s and I was out of the group fully, I got together with him and we were together for 10 years. And he did fix a lot of my problem. He hated that organization. He knew it was full of criminals, and he helped me see it in a good light. But at the time, I was having these dreams about him, and every time I would wake up from a dream about him, I'd just be like, ah, it was like the worst nightmare ever, and it was just really bothering me. So I asked my boss, I told him about the dreams, and he knew the family, he knew these people. And so he said, yeah, go ahead and keep a dream journal. It was like special permission. So I think beyond that, the dreams, they taught us in ISKCON that your dreams are just nothing. They don't mean anything. It just means you ate something bad before you went to sleep. So I didn't really, beyond like trying to get rid of the nightmares, I don't think the dreams played a part in my leaving, but the nightmares did go away after I started living with Kyle later. And the second question was how are my dreams different now? Well, we're going to find out because I'm going to transcribe my 40s, hopefully next year. And in my 40s, I was with Kyle. I was out of the organization. I put a lot of distance between myself and the organization. So I'm expecting that the dreams will be different in the sense that they'll have fewer Sanskrit words, fewer Sanskrit and Bengali words, fewer ISKCON jargon, mostly language. Like, I'm trying to think, like, what makes a cult dream different from a regular dream? So the only thing I've come up with so far is that, oh, it stopped. Recording, all right. The only difference is that the language, like, and a lot of cult involvement is the language, because it's like a secret little club, and everyone talks in code to each other, and outside people are like, you know, or if you try to talk to, like, my mom, I remember she got really upset one time, because I mailed her this long letter that quoted all these Bhagavad Gita verses, and she said when she got the letter, she was just crying, and it upset her. Because, you know, when your kid's in a cult, you can't talk to them. They're just like, oh, you've got to read the Bhagavad Gita. It's ecstatic. It's all in there. You know, and you talk like crazy talk. And so I'm thinking that my after series will have a lot less Sanskrit names and words in it. So maybe there will be other differences. I'll have to... Because now, like, the world of psychology does not acknowledge dreams, and they don't acknowledge cults. And one thing I've thought about is the similarity between the word nightmare and the word cult. Nobody likes to use the word cult because you're automatically insulting whatever group you study. But there's no other word to describe it. Like, you'd say, well, I was in a controlling group, or I was in an authoritarian group, or it was like, you know, a totalist group, you know, where they take up your whole life. But if you were use the word cult, everybody knows what you're talking about. And it's the same with nightmare. Like, nightmare is the only word that you can use to describe that. Like, you could say, I had a really scary dream, or I had this dream I woke up from, it was just awful. Well, you know, but if you use the word nightmare, everyone knows what you're talking about. So there's just some words. That's the only other word that I could think of that's that specific. Sue, I don't know where we stand time-wise.
Other questions?
Two more minutes. Yeah. 2 minutes. Does anyone have a quick question? Otherwise, I'll just talk for 2 more minutes.
Yeah.
Okay, this was an amazing journey. Anyone that's got a long dream journal, even if you're not going to give it up for statistics like I want to do, it's really valuable to transcribe it, especially if you remembered a lot of dreams. And when I turned 60, I knew I had all these boxes of dreams at UCSB, and I just wanted to use them for something. And then I found out how rare it is that someone would keep a dream journal that long, and how they don't use them, and there's no consensus on what dream journals are good for. And then I met Michael Shreddle, and he introduced me to Kelly, to Bill Donhoff, and then I met Kelly Bulkley. So we're like the only people in the world that use dream journals, right? But it's really valuable if you have the time. I mean, this took me 160 hours to transcribe. So it was 40 hours, 40 hours, 40, 40, and then another 20. It's like it was just solid typing. So it takes a lot of energy, but I really recommend it.
Thank you.
Shanice Stepakoff.
Do I need a mic?
Shanice is a clinical psychologist, teaches at California Institute of Integral Studies, and writer and poet.
Yes.
First book coming out, she says.
Thank you. Sorry about the chewing sounds. We finished the monitor. Okay. I'll just use the hair. I'm kind of low tech. Good afternoon, everybody. Or still morning. Good morning. Thank you to Kelly for putting together this panel. It's wonderful to have an opportunity to be on a panel like this, and thanks to Nuri as well. We all shared ideas together. Thanks to IASD for hosting a panel that's a bit different from other stuff that there's been. Can everybody hear me okay? Okay. So there was just a very slight error in the title in the program. In case you ever cite this presentation, and I'll be happy to send it to anybody who wants a copy, it's Dreams of the Divine in a Woman from Young Adulthood to Late Middle Age. So that's how I would want it to be cited. And I didn't put this in the conference program, but now you get to kind of know the secret. I am the woman. They are my dreams. And I've been keeping a long-term dream journal for 32 years, 1985, 86 till the present. I type mine immediately after writing them. I write them with my eyes closed. I've taught myself to write with my eyes closed, my hand moving across the page, dropping down and across. And then I type them, I have to type them the same day or I can't decipher them, because writing with my eyes closed, it becomes impossible to decipher after a day. And I also type up my associations and the context from the preceding day. I do all of that at the same time. So they're all before computers. I did it on a typewriter, and then onto computers. Using the spotlight feature of a Mac computer, I conducted a word search for all the dreams about God, containing the word God, or close synonyms for God, such as Hebrew words for God, Jesus, Christ, Lord, and words for God in non-Western religions, Shiva, Hanuman. I ruled out any that were just mentioning God in a different meaning, like, oh my God, or God, you got to stop doing that, or, in those kind of incidental meanings. I found 58 dreams that contained direct references to God. There were many, many, many more dreams that were religious and spiritual in their themes. But Kelly and I talked about this and dialogued with this together, and we're actually going to try to publish a paper on this. So we've been working on this together, and we decided that it was just way too much to try to get into the hundreds of dreams that had spiritual or religious themes, so we really tried to just limit it specifically to dreams that directly mentioned God or a deity. So there were 58, and then I engaged in a close reading of these 58 dreams and really looked closely at the attributes contained in them. Over 50 attributes of God were identified in that initial process, but these were later consolidated and conceptually clustered into 22 attributes of God from among the 58 dreams. Kelly and I had a number of dialogues to try to identify patterns and themes that were evident in those 58 dreams. And one of the interesting things that leapt out right away
was that the same or very similar qualities of God that have been described in religious and mystical literature through the centuries were also evident in the dreams. So that was kind of an interesting initial finding. Now I'm going to go quickly, and as I said, you can have a copy of this if you want. I'm going to need to go quickly because of time limits, through these 22 attributes of God that were exemplified in at least one dream. Some of them had 3, 4, 5 dreams as exemplars. An entity toward whom we direct our praise and or our gratitude. Here's an example. I embrace her, I take her in my arms, I say a prayer, and me feeling gratitude to God. Here's another one. A little boy standing on the left side of a fireplace, he talks to God and says, "Thank you, God." So some kind of entity to which we direct our gratitude, our praise. 2 is a comforting presence that's available to us, especially in times of hardship. And this presence seems to be accepting, understanding, permissive toward us. In one dream, there's a girl who's dying of AIDS, and in the dream report, it says, it is okay because she is with God, and she feels the presence of God. So that sort of thing. 3 was some entity that hears and responds to our cries and our prayers. This was a dream. At the time, I was fluent in Hebrew. I am Jewish ethnically and religiously, although that's another interesting issue because I have had a number of dreams about Jesus Christ, and I am still sort of engaging with why I'm having those dreams because I identify as Jewish. So that's a whole other paper that I couldn't even completely incorporate into this paper. But I had this dream in Hebrew, Le'elohim lazorli v'hu kol kach shamauti, which means in English, it's for God to help me, and he has so much heard me. And that was within the dream. 4 is totality, wholeness, the context for everything, the backdrop for everything, the space in which everything takes place, kind of like the sand in a traditional Zen rock garden. And this was a dream. It was a scene in a church. And I said, this is part of the dream. When you see dot, 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 it means I had to skip some parts because my dreams tend to be quite long. So these are almost, you know, these are all excerpts. Someone, a man, spreads out large nets all over the stadium, which is now completely empty in the middle. The people are all around it, surrounding an empty square, and the person has spread out nets there from one end to another and gives a lecture, I think it's over a loudspeaker, explaining that God is not any of the ways we have previously conceived him. God is rather like a net, a huge net, which is the context for everything, the background of everything. Everything that takes place within it. They look like safety nets for trapeze artists in the circus. People don't understand what the man is trying to say and they laugh at him, but I feel that I understand it. There's a little bit of synchronicity here because I'm saying this to you now on a loudspeaker. I just noticed that. But anyway, 5, something that's imbued with perfection, beauty, significance. It corresponds to what we mean by the numinous or the numen, and it must be represented by a symbol because somehow it can't be directly represented. Here was a dream where I talked about we sit down at a big dining room table. At the table, there's a beautiful sunflower, golden colored, very perfect, very, very beautiful. It seems imbued with significance and spirituality. I say to the lady, to me, this flower at this time represents God. The lady herself is very clear that there is God and is in a direct relationship with God. So she's a bit surprised that it took my seeing this flower to be sure of God's presence. The sunflower is breathtakingly beautiful. So that's kind of consistent with the idea of the Newman. Something mysterious, something all-knowing that has all the answers, but those answers and that knowledge are beyond what human beings can access. It kind of reminds you of, or me or us, of the end of the book of Job, if you're familiar with that, where God kind of says to Job, you know, what do you know about any of this? Where were you when I was creating the world and all of that? And I had this dream where I said, you know, a child was killed or children were killed. Aisha was a colleague of mine at the time. Asked me what kinds of questions the children will ask about the killings. I tell Aisha, the kinds of questions the kids may ask are, why did this happen? And questions about God. How could God let this happen? I ask Aisha if she can answer the questions about God in the school, and she says, no, it is something that has to be answered at home. This is something about this idea that we don't have the answers, we don't know the answers, and we're wondering, you know, how God does what he does or why he does what he does. I'm saying he, but it could just as easily be she or it. Seven was something that is far greater than us, something majestic, something that's eternal, whereas we are not. It's an entity toward which we feel some sort of awe or humility. In one dream, it alluded to a Hebrew song, Adon Olam, and it's a song that talks all about God's majesty. In another dream, I saw a male wisdom figure that was a hybrid of Rabbi Bosnak, and who most of us know, and John Weir, another spiritually conscious person who has since passed away. Some of you might have known John Weir. I want to tell him about the dream I had a few weeks ago. This is within the dream. And I want to tell him about how in that dream the word prostate stood for prostrate. How the reference to my father's prostate problem was really a reference to his prostrate problem. And that dream was about the need to prostrate yourself before God. So in the dream, I'm wanting to tell this male wisdom figure about this insight, about the importance of prostrating yourself before God. In another one, which this was a very vivid dream for me, I see a sign in Hebrew. At first, I think I know what the sign says, so I don't pay much attention to it or even read the rest of it. I just keep going. And all of a sudden, it hits me what the Hebrew letters say, which prayer it is. It's something about human arrogance in the face of God. Oh, ye of little faith, that type of thing. Something about awe of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. When the line as a whole, that prayer, that quote, whatever it is, hits me, I'm stopped in my tracks, just stopped in my tracks, feeling something like shock, awe, fear, humbled. The prayer is something about human arrogance in the face of God, my arrogance in the face of God. I wake up feeling shaken and scared. Eight, something that holds the complete awareness and memory of our entire life's journey. It's something that pushes for truth, that wants the truth to be known and recognized. It also moves events and situations toward completion. It's something that knows who we really are, is aware of our inner core, of our true nature. I had one dream in which I was uncertain about certain events from my childhood that were apparently repressed. And I said in the dream, God is giving the gift of memory back to me. So a sense that God was making the truth come back to my memory. Another one, I ran into a close friend of mine who was dying. He wasn't really dying, but in the dream he was dying. I know that running into him on the beach like this at such a moment is not just coincidence. It is the universe trying to bring us to completion, which is one of God's major tasks. That was part of the dream report. And another one, an older woman gives a younger woman God's blessing. And when she does so, the woman giving the blessing uses a special middle name for the woman being blessed. And that she, it's nothing I had ever come across before. It was just in the dream. The middle name was Blue Dawn. That's not her real middle name of this person in the dream. And in the dream, the person says, Lila Blue Dawn, I love you. And that this was her God-given name. So this name, Blue Dawn, was the God-given name. So this sense of God kind of knowing our real name, knowing who we are. Nine, an entity that endows us with the capacity for compassion. The ability and the inclination to respond to human suffering. One of my dreams featured the song Solo Pido a Dios, sung by Mercedes Sosa. If you're not familiar with it, it's worth looking up. The words in Spanish translate to, All I ask of God is that I not become indifferent to suffering. So it's not what you'd expect when you're thinking of somebody, oh, I want to ask this of God, I want to ask that of God. And instead the song says, all I ask of God is don't let me become indifferent to suffering. So that was one thing I associated to this kind of concept. And another one, I'm with my daughter, Yana, holding her in my arms. A lot of you have met her. This is the first dream conference in 10 years that she hasn't accompanied me to. She used to always come with me. But anyway, I'm with her, holding her in my arms. I think her head is against my chest area, but I'm not sure. I feel a sense of maternal love for Yana and of agape, compassion and God's love for her. So that sense that we have the capacity for compassion and it comes directly from this entity that I call God or we call God. In Buddhism you have Avalokiteshvara, the goddess of compassion and so forth. In Islam they talk about God the Merciful. 10 was some entity that wants us to have love and peace in our relationships and pushes us in the direction of healing, love, and peace in our relationships with other human beings. Something that comes to mind when I think of this is if any of you ever followed the proceedings of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa, there was a very powerful moment when Archbishop Tutu was trying to get Winnie Mandela to acknowledge some of the serious mistakes she made that contributed to, or believed to have contributed to the death, the killing of one of the young men who was falsely, you know, accused of being a traitor. And at first, Winnie Mandela was quite resistant. She did not want to admit. And Archbishop Tutu kept pushing her and pushing her and pushing her and just saying over and over again, you know, get in touch with, you know, your higher self, your better self. Can't you find it within yourself to apologize? And eventually she did. She got in touch with something very deep and she acknowledged that something had gone horribly wrong. Have some of you ever read about that or seen that? It's very powerful. But anyway, in my dreams, in one, I'm dressed up as Santa Claus on the streets of Mexico. People are coming up to me telling me what they want for Christmas. A woman comes up, and when I ask her what she wants for Christmas, she says something about her relationship with someone in her family. I think it's a mother, and she's talking about her relationship with her daughter and wanting love and peace in that relationship. After speaking in English, she next says the same thing in Spanish. When I tell her that I understood the first time, she says, it's not for me, it's for God. So she's saying it in Spanish now for God to hear. This is within the same dream. At a certain point, Lila appears and she's watching me, waiting for me. As she watches me with each person, she has pride in me and she talks about God being proud of us when we do something good. Another meaning of God, an entity to which or toward whom we direct our invocations for the safety and well-being of others. So we ask the blessing of this entity on behalf of others whom we care about. In this dream, a younger black woman. Actually, this has to do with the Lila Blue Dawn too. It's the same. It's part of the same dream, but a different excerpt. Is sitting next to an older black woman. The older black woman spontaneously gives her a traditional yet self-created blessing. And part of the blessing is the Yivarechacha, which is a traditional Jewish blessing where you put your hands on the person's head and you say, may the Lord bless you and keep you and make his countenance to shine upon you and give you peace. Another meaning causes us to feel frightened, some kind of entity that makes us feel overwhelmed because of its authority and power. It seems to have its own autonomous decision-making power over our lives. It's a power that can direct and influence our lives, and it's apparently not subjected to the control of our ego minds. It's a kind of inscrutable will. Some of you may have come across Jung, one of Jung's definitions of God. Jung has a famous definition of God where he says that I give the name God to all things which cross my willful path recklessly and violently. So, I mean, it's a pretty scary kind of thing that you, and there's a Yiddish expression, a Yiddish proverb, if you want to make God laugh, tell him what your plans are. So it's kind of like, whatever your plans are, God sort of is going to do what God's going to do. So I had this dream where I'm with mundane people and the leader of the mundane community. That's a Gnostic religion. There was day residue there. I did a little bit of work with some mundane people in Jordan. It has the quality of something like a service I went to in Columbia, Maryland. This is within the dream. I'm talking about that quality. When the wind blew over my Malachite statue of an African woman's head, when my life was about to be totally changed, shaken up, and that dream had symbolized that. At that service, in the booklet for the service, I'd seen a prayer that said, "Praise God who causes winds to blow." And it made me realize that it was God who made the statue fall, God who entered through my window unexpectedly, God who was coming into my life. You know, so that sort of sense of otherness that can be quite frightening. 13, God, something that holds us, that carries us forward, provides for us, fulfills our needs, takes care of us. Some examples. Time has moved forward and I forgot to change my watch. My time is standing still. Everyone else is moving forward. Let yourself join the ongoing flow of life. Let yourself be carried forward by God. Something about a phrase about being held in the arms of the universe or being held in the arms of God. This is what is meant by being held in the arms of God. I had one dream where God was at the innermost point, the center, something that directs energy toward the center. It kind of reminded me of the center of a mandala, or when you walk in a labyrinth toward the center. And also, if you've ever come across the beautiful little book, Mr. God, This Is Anna, this little girl who has an intuitive understanding of the divine repeatedly says in the book, "God is in my middle." In this dream, I'm using a Ouija board. There's little pieces of food on the Ouija board. I get the idea of asking a question to the Ouija board, and the question that comes to me is, "Who are you, God?" Case is with me, and he repeats the question. I notice that, not with conscious intention, but just from how things flow, I start to make circles with the food and other material, and I put a lot of focus on the center. I seem to be moving everything toward the center. So that's like in response to the question, "Who are you, God?" I start moving everything toward the center of the Ouija board. And it seems that everything moves toward the centermost point of a circle. I'm pondering the question, "Who are you, God?" And it seems to be coming to me in the form of a center, as if to say, God is at the center, God is in the middle, God is in the innermost point. So that was a pretty strong, vivid dream. 15, God as a spiritual or cosmic presence or energy, the Holy Spirit, toward which we feel some sort of longing to receive, to commune with, to be infused by. I'm on some sort of mountaintop, the area where the crucifixion is believed to have taken place. I hear or learn of some kind of evidence that documents that the crucifixion really did take place. I have a strong experience of the presence or energy of God or the Holy Spirit. I pray, saying something about Jesus Christ to come into me, or being ready to receive Christ in me, or something like that. It feels very powerful. The longing and passion are very strong. I have a sense of the Spirit of Christ entering me. Another one, I see my friend Irene. I mentioned to her that I'm thinking of starting to wear a head covering. As I visualize it, it's not the kind of head covering that covers the entire head. It looks like the kind that just covers part of the head that religious Jewish women wear to feel more connected to God or to express their desire for connection to God. Shortly before this, I had a kind of longing of wanting to be closer to God. And I felt a sense of respect and appreciation for the way that when you're a Muslim, it's easy to feel connected to God because it's built into the religion that you will pray 5 times a day. So you, when you pray, you'll be feeling connected to God. I feel some sense of longing for that sort of connection with God. 16 is cosmic mind, some sort of divine plan, cosmic plan, already has decided and knows about the unfolding of time. All seeing is able to see across vast and comprehensive space. And in Hebrew, the word for time and space is the same, ha'olam, the world, and forever in the past, forever into the future is all olam. December 9, 2008, enfolded, time is enfolded. I realized for the first time that something that has now happened was prophesized before it happened, which if it happened would call into question the entire structure of time or the entire structure of our conceptions about time. The awareness of the reality of the phenomenon of prophecy dawns on me, enfolded, crinkled, compacted like an accordion. Then it expands outward from God's mind like something that is tightly coiled and then unfolds. I feel amazed, perplexed, confused, baffled. That was a very, very strong dream with a lot of abstract concepts in it. God as life energy, source of endless vitality. One dream where it had the lyrics to the song Morning Has Broken, which is about renewal and regeneration. Child thanks God for helping him grow each year. A dream that related to Zorba the Greek, allusions to the energy that makes an egg hatch, that sort of archetypal energy. Some entity that cares about humanity works through other human beings for the good of humanity. Obviously, that's the Christian narrative. And in one dream, I see this man, Ray Tai, who is a philanthropist. He has since passed away, but he used to give millions and millions of dollars for medical care of people who were in desperate need. Amazing guy in Boston. And he has become, in my dream, a very spiritual person. And he's sending me on some sort of mission, spiritual in nature, to go and give his brother my blessing, the tune of Hashki Venu, which is a prayer to God, was connected with that mission that Ray was sending me on. God, as that which places opportunities in our past, chooses to cause certain events or situations to come up in our lives. In one dream, God has placed an opportunity in my path. So I talked about that in the dream. In another, I talked about this happened, and it was, you know, this happened in my life, and it was because of the intervention of God, the will of God. Another is just an emanation, a non-corporeal being, defying the usual sensory modalities. In one dream, a voice without sound, the voice is somehow the words, like silent words, that belong to or emanates from Jesus, says something like, I am Jesus Christ, God, or I am Jesus Christ, I am God, or I, Jesus Christ, am God, or Jesus Christ is God. That was the whole dream. 21, something that has a fearsome or awe-inspiring authority and demands sacrifice and propitiation. I don't know how to pronounce that, but propitiation, whatever. A sense of a question being posed to me. What have you done to propitiate the gods in exchange for them having let Jay come into your life? What have you done to sacrifice to the gods in thanks? And the last one, revelation. God somehow is this entity that doesn't want to let us see or know all at once, at least not for certain periods of time. This entity prefers gradual self-revelation, a partial image followed by a more complete image. And last summer I was traveling in Sicily. I was looking at a lot of Caravaggio paintings, and I had this extremely powerful, vivid dream. I can't go through the whole dream because it's a long dream, but in that dream there were those Dutch-style doors where they could open from either the top or the bottom, but not both at the same time, so you would get a partial view of the room. And the phrase, through a glass darkly, came to mind within the dream, which is from the New Testament and talks about that now we don't see all of it, we just see through a glass darkly, but someday in the future we'll see more and we'll know more. And in that dream, I saw a figure that looked like Jesus that had a horizontal figure 8 over its head, which is like an infinity sign. that was floating like a halo, and that is also seen in one of the tarot cards. And I had the sense that it was somehow held in place, and it was a very, very powerful dream. But there was this sense in the dream, because the door of this special kind of door, that God was not going to reveal itself, himself, herself, all at once, that there would always be just a partial view. And so I don't really have time to go into this anymore, but I did kind of summarize some basic observations and conclusions, that it seems like from these dreams that some of the ways we experience the divine arise endogenously within the human psyche. That might be related to a Jungian view. I do have 2 minutes. And it might suggest that Jung was accurate in his view that God might be an archetype within the collective unconscious that arises in religious texts, art, poetry, myths, visionary experiences, and in our dreams. We could also hypothesize that maybe God really exists externally, that maybe it's not only endogenous within the mind or the psyche. We don't really know for sure. And the other part, and Kelly and I have talked about this, is that in the phenomenology of religious experience and the representation of God, or representations of God, these dreams kind of show that there's a tremendous multiplicity of qualities. There's lots of different names for God in Judaism and in the Hebrew Bible, and there seem to be lots of different attributes of the divine. I also had dreams with other names for God from other religions and that sort of thing. So it's my first time presenting this material. It's exciting to have such a great group of listeners, and thank you very much. Okay, I could take a few questions, Kelly said. Yeah, that was one, an entity toward whom we direct our praise and our gratitude.
It's not showing up.
Oh, it's not showing up anymore.
Yeah. That's right. No, I can fix it.
Okay, and number two was, I haven't memorized the order of these, so number two, okay, there we go, and number two was a comforting presence that gives us comfort in times of hardship. Does that answer your question? Yeah. Any other questions? Yeah.
Thank you so much for that very encyclopedic presentation. Don Bisson, who is a spiritual director and Jungian therapist, Pierre's brother, has indicated that he has a theory that when we see dream images from traditions other than our own, right, that in this case it might be our unconscious calling us to pay particular attention to that image and what's transpiring in the dream at that particular time.
Interesting.
You know, so that if you were a rabbi saying Kiddush on the Bima or on a Friday night, okay, so but to be a priest doing communion in a church for a Jewish woman, this might be your unconscious going, whoa, you know, better check out what this means here in terms of its amplification, wider meaning, and why your unconscious is setting you that image at that time.
Thank you for that. Excellent point. Thank you. I would take that on board. Yeah. Okay, thank you. Oh, do you have a question? I want to make sure Kelly has enough time. Yeah.
maybe you're going to cover this, Kelly, but the number of times that God actually appears as a word in dreams is generally pretty small. But what you've defined here is aspects, that you have found in dreams that were related to the word you found God in the dreams. But those aspects may be in many other dreams. Correct. That don't use that word.
Exactly.
God. Yeah, I just did a search and about 0.2% of the time is the word God you show up in dreams.
Yes.
Yeah. But the aspects are very interesting because they can appear without that term.
Yes, and there's a lot more with the aspects. I mean, there's hundreds, and there were just 58 with the actual word. Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you for that. Yeah.
Just quickly, I'm not sure I even know where to go with this, but I'm very struck by the comprehensive experience that you've been given of God. I guess, so my basis of comparison is having gone to seminary and kind of chopped around and looked at all of this, but I've never seen it all in one list. And it seems like that your life has like compiled this whole comprehensive encounter, which to me is really phenomenal, because if I think of my life and experience, I'm not sure that I've encountered all of these things in a way that's existential and sort of personally transmitted. So I just find I feel like I'm in the presence of a mystic.
Oh, so. Wow, thank you.
Just one quick question.
Okay, thank you for that.
Just really quick, two parts. At any point during your dreams, did God, Goddess, all being, if you will, appear as sort of like a physical entity, as a human or anthropomorphic sort of type? And two, as you have these multitude of experiences, did you ever share it with close friends and family, and what would their reactions or responses be? Or did you even feel comfortable sharing that with them? Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Thank you. So no, I haven't shared these with anybody except Kelly and you guys, and my therapist, but not even much with her, because she's actually not really oriented in that way, which is okay. We work on other stuff. but your first question, the only dream I think might fit with what you're talking about there is I did have a dream about Hanuman, the monkey god. That was the only one that really seemed embodied in a corporeal kind of form. Of course the Jesus, if you think of Jesus as God, which we, I don't know, but I have had a few dreams where Jesus appeared as a physical person, like the one with the halo over his head. Yeah, thank you. All right, thanks for the extra time, Kelly. I appreciate that. Thank you. Yes.
It's been a real pleasure and honor to work with Nori and Shani on their dream journals and
amazing collections of dreams. These are both works in progress, so you may hear more about this going forward. Great, thank you. Go in a historical direction here and share some research that I've been working on for the past couple of years, titled The Dreams of God of Lucretia de Leon. So more than 400 years ago, a young woman with a gift for prophetic dreaming was persecuted as a traitor and a heretic. Her dreams were judged by the religious authorities to be a threat to the king, to the church, and to the country as a whole. She was imprisoned, interrogated, tortured, and violently punished because of her dreams. All of this happened despite the fact that her dreams came true. She accurately predicted a national disaster that could have been avoided if her dreams had been heeded. Instead, she was punished as an enemy of God. So in this presentation, I'm going to share one of the arguments I've developed in favor of this young woman's innocence against the charges levied against her. And I'm going to discuss a set of her dreams that included references to God, and to consider how those dreams relate to both her personal religious life and her religious community. I'm going to focus on one dream in particular, which I hope will give you a sense of her dreams overall. They're very long dreams, very, very complicated. But I hope give you a sense of how she regarded her dreams as meaningful, important, and theologically legitimate phenomena. Her name was Lucretia de Leon. She lived in 16th century Spain. So this is a little graphic showing, wrong way. I'm looking at this there. So Madrid, the center of the country. At this time, England and all the Protestants are to the north, Ottoman Empire to the east, Muslim North Africa, constant threat to the south, and the New World, silver and gold, all that way. So that was the lay of the land in the 16th century. Lucretia was born in October of 1568, just a couple years after William Shakespeare was born. Madrid was the new capital of the vast Spanish Empire, and its intensely Catholic ruler, King Philip II, the most Catholic king as he was known. Her parents gave her the name Lucretia, hearkening back to the Roman legend of a young, supremely virtuous young woman named Lucretia, who was raped by the son of the king, Prince Tarquin. This is one of the many, many artistic portrayals of the story, which is very well known at the time. Even though Lucretia in the story was blameless of the assault, she killed herself in order to prevent any taint of dishonor from attaching itself to her family name. So ever after, in Roman and then in Catholic culture, Lucretia became an emblem of sort of the supreme female virtues of obedience, chastity, and self-sacrifice. We know that Lucretia de León's parents, her father, Alonso, was proud of being an old Christian, a Spaniard, a pure Christian blood with no foreign elements, no taint. And it seemed likely that he and his wife, Anna, chose the name Lucretia for their firstborn child to emphasize the absolute necessity and importance of female modesty and servility and obedience. Well, alas for Alonso and Anna, their firstborn child was a big dreamer. And from early childhood, she gained a reputation in her neighborhood as someone whose dreams came true. In the fall of 1587, let's see, where do I want to be with my slides here? Yeah, this is fine. In the fall of 1587, a powerful nobleman, Don Alonso de Mendoza, who was interested in apocalyptic symbols and omens, heard about Lucretia, and he became fascinated by her dreams. Because she was illiterate, uneducated, he arranged for a priest to come to her house every morning and, in the context of confession, report her dreams to the priest that she had the previous night. Many of her dreams revolved around Spain's holy war against England and the Protestant Queen Elizabeth. For years, King Philip had been holing up in his religious sanctuary, the El Escorial, where he made plans to launch an invasion of England using the most powerful navy in the world, the Spanish Armada. Philip claimed a holy mandate for this invasion, and the church whipped the country into a frenzy of religious intensity and anger towards the Protestants in England. In this heated and religiously militarized atmosphere, Lucretia dreamed repeatedly that the Armada would fail. From the fall of 1587 through the summer of 1588, her dreams, as recorded by the priests that Don Alonso sent to her house, mentioned the Armada several times, always in negative terms. And when the Armada was defeated by the English in the fall of 1588, everyone in Spain was shocked. Everyone, that is, except for Lucretia and her followers. In the year or so following this, Lucretia's dreams became more widely known as people looked for new guidance in the aftermath, the incredible shock and disillusionment that came after the defeat of the Armada. Lucretia's popularity aroused the ire of the king, who in the spring of 1590 personally ordered Lucretia arrested by the Spanish Inquisition on charges of treason and heresy. She was taken to the Inquisition's secret prison in the ancient city of Toledo, the spiritual capital of Spain, where she was held for 5 years before a final verdict was rendered in her case. The main source of evidence against Lucretia were her dreams, dutifully recorded by Don Alonso's priests, all of whom were also arrested and imprisoned in Toledo. And this is a toca. This is a funnel that was used to essentially waterboard her. This is the main form of torture that was used by the Inquisition. They were forbidden from shedding blood, so they had to find non-bloody ways of torturing people. And so this was the implement of choice. And these dreams are still available for study today in the National Historical Archive of Spain in Madrid. So this is one of the dreams. It's a long, long dream. All her dreams were very long. But let me read this for you, and you'll get a sense of some of the ways that her dreams worked. The 1st of December of this year, 1587, the ordinary man, el hombre ordinario, came to me and, calling me, said, "Stick your head out the window of her bedroom," which I did, and I heard a great noise, and I asked him, "What noise is this I hear?" He answered, "You will soon see." And then I saw coming from the east a cart pulled by two bulls or buffaloes, in which I saw a tower, on the side of which there was a dead lion, and on top of which was a dead eagle with its breast cut open. The wheels of this cart were stained with blood, and as it moved, it killed many people. And many men and women dressed as Spaniards were tied to the cart. They were shouting that the world was ending. Not having ever seen anything like this, I asked, "What vision is this?" The ordinary man told me that he could not say, although he showed signs that he wanted to. In this instant, the old fisherman appeared, and I asked him, "Why have you left the seashore and come here?" He responded that it was necessary to come because this man, the ordinary man, wanted to tell me about this vision, and it should not be known until the third night. I saw that he was carrying a palm leaf, which it seemed he was creating right there, sort of magically in his hand. I asked him, "Who is this palm leaf for?" And he said, "For the new king who will be to God's pleasing. I will give it to him, but for the moment I cannot say any more." And then I woke up. Lucretia's dreams often began in the normal setting of her house, looking out her bedroom window, and then something fantastic and otherworldly would happen. She would journey to a faraway land, she would see something amazing in the street, as in this case, or she'd go to the royal palace for an intimate conversation with the king. El hombre ordinario, the ordinary man, was a nearly constant presence in her dreams, and so is El viejo, the old man, also known as El pescador, the old fisherman. A third figure, known as the young fisherman or the lion man, also appeared frequently. And these three companions, as she called them, usually appeared in a coastal setting, on a beach or cliff overlooking the ocean, and hence her surprise in this dream at seeing them in the city rather than at the seashore. Many other dreams besides this one included strange animals, bloody violence, apocalyptic warnings, and a variety of allegorical symbols. The emotional tenor tended towards the negative, fear of the enemies besieging Spain from all directions, and despair at the inability of the king to protect his people. This first report highlights a theme in many of Lucretia's dreams, which is a capacity for self-awareness and metacognition. Almost every one of her dreams included sophisticated processes of thought and conscious reflection, and at one point during her trial and interrogation, she said, "I wake up the moment my eyes are closed." When she goes to sleep, it was like her eyes open. And in this way, she wasn't really speaking metaphorically. I think she was literally describing the highly conscious nature of her dreams. And so many of her dreams had two levels of activity. There's sort of what was happening. She sees the sight, the cart, the blood, all these symbols. And then there's another level where she's asking her companions, what's going on? What vision is this? How do I interpret this? How do I understand this? And then the companions would kind of argue amongst themselves. They never entirely agreed. They would say, "Well, you can't know now. We'll tell you later." And in some of the dreams, the companions would complain about Don Alonso de Mendoza and some of the other priests who were misinterpreting the dream. So there's these complicated conscious and interpretive themes running through all of her dreams. And a core concern here and in many of the dreams was the fate of the king, and the question of who would replace him on the throne. The old fisherman, this magically appearing palm leaf, which is a common Christian symbol of spiritual victory, made it clear that King Philip's reign must end, so a new king, to God's pleasing, could lead Spain to a better future. The character of God played an intriguing role in Lucretia's dreams. For a pious Catholic of her time who went to church, perhaps daily, who'd been hearing Bible stories from the beginning of her life, living perhaps in the most intensely Catholic place maybe there's ever been. I mean, Madrid in the late 16th century was a very Catholic place. It would be unsurprising for her to dream at least periodically of God, with references to God. But her dreams seem to go well beyond that, however, with the majority of her dreams presenting God as an important character in his own right. Her dreams portrayed God as an absent but very involved figure with a range of strong thoughts and feelings. He gave stern warnings and explicit instructions about how to behave. He was happy when people treated him well and obeyed his commandments, and he was angry when they ignored his will. He showed no hesitation in sending his wrath to punish evil people and teach them a lesson, even if innocent people were harmed as a consequence. Although he created this world, he had plans to destroy it because of its sinfulness and to create a new world in the future. He cared for those who obeyed him, however, and showed them mercy despite their failings. He seemed to be aware of the prophetic information the three companions were passing to Lucretia, allowing it to happen, yet controlling the flow so she was not overwhelmed. The three companions could not be reduced to characters from the Bible, but they always seemed to act in accordance with God's will. And in several dreams, they seemed to serve as direct representatives of God, sort of like angels, not exactly angels, but something along those lines. Well, all of this would be generally consistent with the standard portrait of God in Catholic theology. There's nothing in Lucretia's dreams that violated Catholic or church teachings about the nature of the supreme deity or his involvement in human history. She never dreamed of God speaking directly to her or favoring her with special gifts or blessings. And this actually was important. This gave her some protection during her trial. Other mystics and visionaries boasted about their special communications with God. And the Inquisition usually viewed these kinds of claims as a punishable form of spiritual arrogance. Lucretia made no such claims. God in her dreams was vividly known, but not seen or heard. His will shaped everything, and everyone was subject to his emotional reactions, although he never actually appeared to make a command or do something evil. He was omnipresent, yet never present. His character was woven into the very fabric of Lucretia's dream world, just as the church taught her was true of God's existence in the waking world. And I think this is another instance of a strong continuity between her dreams and her waking life. And I could tell you of other dimensions of continuity, but this religious continuity is very strong between her dreams and her waking life, the religious beliefs of her time and place. And I think this fits well with other evidence indicating that she was not a heretic. She wasn't a witch. She wasn't a bruja. She was a deeply and sincerely faithful Catholic who fully accepted the reality, power, and righteous judgment of the biblical God. Well, let me conclude. Yes, I see I'm coming to the end of sort of the talking time here. With the idea that Lucretia's abilities as a prophetic dreamer were unusual but not unique. Other people in various places and times, including people today, have experienced similar phenomena. Perhaps everyone has the potential for such dreams given the right circumstances. Lucretia's dreams highlight latent abilities within the human psyche that are real, powerful, and potentially valuable, although they may appear threatening to traditional religious and political authorities. And I think this is true today as well. The wild multiplicities of dreaming inevitably run into conflict with rigid, monolithic systems of thought and behavior. In a world where boundaries are hardening and clashes between ideological tribes are worsening, the act of dreaming and the act of sharing our dreams becomes a meaningful political gesture. Dreams remind us of our spiritual freedom and capacity for growth, and they help us see the world from many perspectives besides that of our waking ego. They tap into our deepest source of creative insight, and in cases like Lucretia's, they envision dire threats to the community that could be avoided if consciously recognized. They are perhaps our most reliable source of connection with the divine. All right, thank you. That's that. El Hombre Ordinario, she described him once as looking somewhat like John the Baptist. So when she described him as the ordinary man, it wasn't like he was ordinary. It was just like he showed up a lot in her dreams. He actually, when she described him as looking like John the Baptist is traditionally portrayed as wearing sort of animal skins, kind of a young, spiritually haunted person. So he was, whoever the ordinary man was, he was not an ordinary God. So any questions or comments?
Some more of a comment.
Sure.
And in the interest of self-disclosure, uh-huh. We're at a dream conference. So,
yeah.
I do empathize a bit with, uh-huh. I'm butchering uh-huh. her name.
Lucretia.
Lucretia.
Yeah.
In the sense of, having these spontaneous experiences and then the unknown ramifications from, you know, the collective. Or at least, so I empathize with that because, you know, I've had my own experiences through dreams and other, you know, visions and dream meditations and stuff like that. In fact, I had shared one of my dream groups at the conference. And I also shared, you know, my ambivalence or hesitation and sort of like really being selective with whom I share those with. And it's, you know, it's really happy to be the closest of closest friends, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Or
yeah.
Folks who are like-minded, we talk about them spiritually. Because of, I was raised Catholic, I came from the Caribbean, you know, as a result of slavery and, you know, in, colonization. But, you know, I did leave the church, and, you know, after leaving the church, maybe there were dreams of God, or, you know, but certainly it had built up, the Catholic Church had built up a concept or a construct, an image of God. So when I started having these encounters, they defied those.
Right.
And that created a bit of inner tension, as and sort of like, as well as, well, what do I do with this? Who do I go to? Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't feel safe because of like, what do I do with this?
Right,
you
know? Right, right.
So, and when you talk about it, you know, at the conclusion of it, of the risks of that, I can, in terms of the socio-cultural, political ramifications of having these sort of visions and experiences hopefully shared when you go up against those rigid, dogmatic paradigms.
Yeah,
I do kind of empathize and sympathize a bit with
No, along those lines, it was interesting to hear Nori talk about how ISKCON had no use for dreams, right? I mean, and you know, I have a line in here, you know, if you're really attached to rigid, monolithic forms of thought and behavior, dreams aren't your friend in ancient times and modern times as well. Yeah, that's thank you for that. And maybe we're all lucky that we weren't born in 16th century Spain. If any of us here had been born in 16th century Spain, it'd probably be very uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And so, you know, and she, well, her parents were not happy that this was happening at all. She said they beat her as a child to make her stop dreaming, and she kept dreaming. Her father threatened to kill her if she didn't stop. It was only because these priests said, hey, this is okay. And we're going to do this in confession, and if you're doing it in confession, it's theologically fine. And Don Alonso de Mendoza was a very powerful member of the nobility, so she, as I read the story, she trusted them that this was going to be an okay place, and she was doing it not for herself, but because this mattered to the country. So the king and the Inquisition didn't see it that way, but that's yeah, so be careful. Any other comments or questions, or generally speaking? Yeah, come on up.
Yes, this is a question from Nori.
Yeah.
It was very powerful hearing you talk about being in the cult. But I found myself thinking that Krishna is actually, you know, one of the most delightful aspects of the Indian pantheon. And there are millions of people who worship him to this day in a very positive way. So my question is, after you left the cult, have you continued to dream of Krishna as representing the deity, but in a positive way that's meaningful to you?
I think all the dreams were positive, and I was, after leaving, I wanted to keep the parts of the experience that I liked, which was basically everything except the politics and the criminal stuff that was going on. So I spent years just sorting it, sifting it, getting rid of what I didn't like and keeping what I liked. So when I transcribe the rest of the dreams, I'll find out, but I still, like I said, you know, Jagannath and Krishna, you know, it's still a part of my life. Yeah. Oh, I also wanted to mention that card that I passed out has the URL where I'm keeping track of everything about the study. So I'm posting statistics. I posted all the dreams of God, the dreams of God are posted there. So that's it. Did she pass out that card?
Yeah.
That's the URL where I'll be posting and keeping track of my research. So thank you for that question. That's really nice.
Thank you very much, you know, for all the talks, really enjoyable. Yeah, I have a question for you. You said that Lucretia was not tried as a bruja. So what was the charge, and were there any similar trials at the time?
Yeah, that's kind of the one of the challenges here. Thanks. So I mentioned she was held in prison for 5 years. That's as far as I can tell, it's one of the longest times someone was imprisoned by the Inquisition. The Inquisition, like, they'd arrest you, they wouldn't tell you why you're arrested, they'd just say, okay, confess what you've done. You're guilty, so this is pastoral care, so you confess and then we'll figure out how to punish you for the bad things you've done. So it's so completely stacked against a person. And the fact that it took them 5 years to figure out what to do with her, I think is evidence that some of them knew that she wasn't a bad person. She wasn't a heretic. She wasn't a traitor. She was a big dreamer whose dreams had been borne out by events. So they didn't know what to charge her with. Well, she was charged with treason and heresy. So she was formally charged with, like, the worst, you know, things that in most Inquisition cases would lead to a very harsh punishment very quickly. And yet her case just went on and on for several years, a lot of strange things happening in the prison during this time. So that to me is evidence that they knew she wasn't a witch, she wasn't a heretic, she wasn't a Protestant, you know, God forbid. Any of the categories that the Inquisition usually applied to take care of people they had imprisoned, none of those fit her case. And so I think they just kind of hoped she would die in prison. You know, I just kind of hoped she, because a lot of people did, you just would die. And she didn't. She actually had a child in prison. She was pregnant when she first went into prison, had a daughter, raised her, but was eventually convicted. I won't ruin the ending, but she was not executed. She was just punished very, very harsh. So, Fariba, you have one more question, and I think we wrap up. And for any of us, but yeah.
This was wonderful.
Thank you.
I just wanted to say that something that I don't talk publicly, and I can say it here, when I was doing my research about experiencing the divine in lucid dream, I got two death threats. One from a fundamental Muslim, one from a fundamental Christian. And the premises was, how dare you asking people to go and find God in their dreams? And that is traditionally, these experiences were reserved for priests and kings,
yeah,
but not to ordinary people.
Yeah.
So I think that still is.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Be aware of who you share your dreams.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think that is still is that is out there. I didn't put my research out for a whole year.
Yeah.
And that's one of the reasons I didn't bring it out publicly, was because of that.
Yeah.
So it's that persecution is still around.
Yeah. It is. It is. Well, that's a grim note.
I just wanted to just quickly one
sure.
That's only because of
all right. Okay. So anybody who needs to depart for lunch, feel free. But we've got a couple more here. Yeah.
Wanted to just share, put it out there, especially in light of Fariba's comment. Something that was in one of my experiences that was told to me that I heard was be judicious in your approach.
Yeah.
And it was sort of echoed, sort of like be judicious in your approach. Especially, so learn discernment. Learn just be very selective on the, you know, the circumstances, especially when it comes around this type of issue, this topic or these experiences.
Mm.
So I think sort of carrying that, I think I just want to share as well, sort of as well.
All the power that comes out through our dreams is going to have an impact in the world, and there are people who might not be happy. People who are very invested in the status quo, kind of like things the way they are, they don't like dreams, right? Because dreams are kind of shaking things up, pushing us to go somewhere new. Yeah, so thank you. You're the last.
I'll just say the big duh because I'm the turtle that fell off the truck. But it really, I'm just thinking of, just with all that was shared here, I'm so inspired about the potential for interfaith work through dreams.
Yeah.
And it seems, I'll probably get this wrong, but my understanding of Midrash is that it's sort of this conversation, and
yes.
out of the conversation comes this sense.
Yes.
And it seems like in the dreams of Lucretia that there's the dream part, but then there's the lucid part where this
yes.
this sort of midrash going on, and then this
yeah.
kind of sense of like where it's going. So there's kind of maybe the underground, like don't reveal too much, but then maybe there's the overground.
Hmm.
I don't know, maybe there's kind of a groundswell of dream work that can help us kind of break the complex that our culture's in,
yeah.
religious complex.
Yeah, across different views and traditions. Okay, that's a happier note to end on. I like that. Okay, thank you. Well, thanks to our panelists, and thank you for your attention.